And welcome to Radio Free Canada. It's January 22nd. This is Kevin Annett, your host, as always. And that's going out, of course, to all of my ancestors in the Scottish Highlands and also our new allies in Scotland and England. You'll hear about that in a minute. Today, we are actually doing a replay of a show from October 2015, which will be very relevant, as you'll find out. It's a three-way discussion between me, Ryan Gable, my co-host, and Andrew Patterson, that Canadian who took on the Canada Revenue Taxation Department and said, no, I'm not funding a genocidal regime. We're going to hear about that in a minute. But as part of this short intro, I wanted to remind folks that we are heading into a very important time, and it's very important to be clear within ourselves. The personal reclamation precedes everything, of course. And as part of that, I want to start with a wonderful quote from a fellow who lived almost 2,000 years ago, and no, not Jesus Christ, although we'll get to him too sometime. But his name was Marcus Aurelius, and here is his words for us today. All you have is the present moment, and that is all you ever lose. So how will you use this moment? Will you direct events or be directed by them? The one who controls his own mind directs all things and is impregnable. For such a one is living according to universal nature, which cannot be taken from him by any army or malevolent wrongdoer. Such a one learns that no place of retreat and relaxation offers him more quiet than within his own mind. So away with distraction and other people's thoughts, and learn to acquire your own reason and virtue, which is all that distinguishes you from the rude beast of the field. And from this learn that to apply your principles, you must be as the boxer rather than the gladiator. For the gladiator must pick up the sword he uses, but the boxer always has his hands and needs only clench them into fists. All that you need to be upright, just, and courageous in this life, you have within yourself, that fragment of divinity that the gods have given each person to guard and guide him. Make yourself simpler and better. Thank you, Marcus. Right to the heart of things, I think. And so as we go into the show today, please keep in mind that, and especially in the light of the so-called U.S. election, we don't change the nature of the adversary. We have documented for the last 22 years the crimes of genocide in Canada. We've exposed them. We've confronted the evildoers. We've prosecuted and convicted them. And we've even disestablished them under international law. But their regime continues. It's not so much that we're going to destroy the adversary overnight, but we can reclaim our power from it. We can take back our power on a personal, a spiritual, and a political level and become self-governing people, self-governing congregations, self-governing political communities. That's the whole focus of what we do on this show. And so in the weeks ahead, we're going to intensify that. Next week on the January 29th show, we're going to be continuing our discussion of home rule self-government and how to establish it, and also use it as a springboard to take on the crimes against our children and others. And 2 weeks later, we're actually beginning a new program over in England and Scotland. In conjunction with Freedom Talk Radio Scotland and Andy Peacher, we are establishing a sister show to Radio Free Canada called Radio Free Anglia. It starts Sunday, February 5th, 11 a.m. Pacific time in Canada. That would be 2 p.m. Eastern time and 7 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. That's Sunday, February 5th, Radio Free Anglia. There's a notice about it right now at itccs.org, our regular website. So go to itccs.org, read more on that, and stay strong and clear over the weeks ahead. We will talk to you next week live once again here on Radio Free Canada. Hope you enjoy the show. Thank you, brothers and sisters.
I'll raise it if I can. Soldiers have their sorrow. The wretched have their rage. Pray for the aged, it's the dawn of another age, of another age, of another age, of another age, of another age.
Welcome to Radio Free Canada. I'm your host, Kevin Annett. Welcome back to all our faithful listeners and all our new listeners. It's Sunday, October 4th. We are here every Sunday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the BBS Radio Network. You can follow all of our programs at bbsradio.com, Radio Free Canada, and on our website, canadarepublic.ca. And we are back with
our co-host Ryan Gable, of course, and our special guest today, Andrew Patterson. Andrew is I would call him not only a good friend, but a kick-ass common law warrior on the west coast of Canada, and it's a pleasure to have him back. I'm going to get to these guys in a minute. I just want to highlight kind of what we're going to talk about today. Carrying on from the themes of the last number of shows, we'll be maybe doing a rehash of some observations, personal and otherwise, on the the farce that happens south of the border, or maybe in America, if that's where you're listening, with the Bergoglio visit. And I think, you know, one of the only honest thing Pope Francis said during his entire trip was when he was speaking to the United Nations. He made the remark, "I speak only in my own name," which is quite a remarkable thing for the Bishop of Rome to say when you think about it. He's just acting as an individual speaking in his own name. Let me just ask you to hold on to that thought and let that digest in your gray matter for a little minute. And because it's very relevant to what we're going to talk about today, we're shifting the focus over the next few weeks to the situation in Canada because, of course, there's a federal election coming up on, that's what they like to call it. I have a more crude term for it, but I won't say that over the air at the moment. But October 19th is the, okay, I'll say it, what the hell. Okay, this is BBS Radio, you guys don't mind. One of my friends in Vancouver several years ago said, it's not an election, it's an erection, because we all get screwed, right? Okay, so the federal election on October 19th in Canada, where we get to choose between, count them, four different political parties, but the problem is they're all taking the same oath of allegiance to the same criminally convicted foreign ruler, that is Queen Elizabeth and all of her descendants. So whoever you elect, you're committing an act of treason. We're going to be talking about that today. Why and how must Canadians must disengage from the system, and why under natural law and international law, and what can we build to replace it? This is going to be the matter of much talk and reflection, and at both ends of the radio today. I hope that you'll participate, write down your questions and thoughts, and continue to write in as you're doing constantly. This show is for those of you out there who think are tempted to give up hope. We're not giving up hope, so we don't expect you to. We're going to carry on. We have a world to win back, people. So let me go to Andrew. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be here.
It's always good to have you, brother. And Ryan, of course, say a few words, Ryan, for all the folks out there.
Yeah, well, first of all, hello, Andrew. Hello, Kevin. It's good to be back again. And I'm interested to learn a little bit more about the Canadian election process and how much of a sham it is compared to the American election process, because it's on about the same level, I think.
Well, I don't know. Do you want to comment, Andrew, or I'd love to hop in, but go ahead if you want.
Well, you know, I think the best way to look at it is theater. It's a very absorbing theater, even though it's poorly done and over-budgeted. But you have to admit that they managed to keep the vast majority, if not just about everyone, fooled into thinking that it's a real legitimate process. But in fact, it's just theater, and we'll get into some details about how really whatever choice you make, if you do decide to vote, you're simply voting for the Rockefellers.
Right. That's
we'll get into some detail if you'd like to.
Well, just to add to that, too, that an amazing number of people in Canada don't even know the oath of allegiance, the oath of office that every member of parliament takes when you elect them. And it is the following, quote, "I swear true allegiance to Queen Elizabeth II and all of her descendants," unquote. That's the oath. That's, you know, if you elect somebody, usually there's conditions attached, one would think, in some kind of normal contractual relationship. You say, okay, I'll put you in office, but you've got to agree to do this and that. Well, the only thing they agree to do is not even owe you allegiance, but they're going to obey this woman sitting across the water who owns most, if not all, of the country and is a convicted criminal. So, you know, that's why the political shade of who you elect really is irrelevant when the system is rigged. But Ryan, do you mean in terms of the specifics of how it happens, or what were you thinking when you asked that?
Just in the aspect of how corrupt it truly is, and as you go out and vote, I mean, it is a big feeder, of course, but how corrupt every individual is running, or not necessarily even corrupt, because most people, they look at this process and they say, well, yeah, everybody on both sides, they've done something that I don't necessarily agree with. But this goes a little bit deeper than that. I mean, this is void of democracy. It's just a big, it's like a big movie that we're watching, and we think that it's reality, but it's really not. It's being played out behind the scenes. So when you do vote for one of these people on either side, you're still voting for the same hand that stirs the pot, if that makes sense. I just wanted to basically kind of get an idea if the Canadian system is very much like the American system, where there really is not more than a couple of people that even get an opportunity for the big time political runs that have the ability to actually change something. Even if
One of the differences, kind of formally speaking, is in America, there's supposed to be some kind of formal checks and balance. You know, we know that doesn't exist in practice, but the executive, the legislature, and the judicial are supposed to be relatively independent. In Canada, they never made that claim. We've never moved out of a colonial system. And a perfect example of that, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Canada, Beverly McLaughlin, is also a member of what's called the Privy Council. Now, the Privy Council traditionally was a group of advisors around the king or the queen, and is the colonial system around the one official head of state in Canada who's not the prime minister who's elected. No, it's the governor general who's appointed by the queen, and he's the official queen's representative and head of state in Canada. So this guy can get rid of any government he likes. As a matter of fact, and for people who say, oh, he'd never do that, in 1975 in Australia, a Labour government refused to ratify a nuclear weapons treaty with the United States. Guess what the Governor General of Australia did? He removed the Labour government. There was an election. The good old Tories got in, and they signed the treaty with America. So, I mean, when they want to, they can exercise that power. And, in effect, you know, there is no separation of powers at all in Canada. And, you know, Andrew, you know very well the whole story of genocide in residential schools. That was played out, you know, to a T, when church and state were continually covering for each other in you know, perpetrating that massive crime.
Yeah, and the government exonerated the churches before their show trial, whatever you want to call it, began. It didn't have any consequence to the guilty parties.
Right.
None.
So, you know, I mean, it's a very interesting, the different psychology, too. Canadians are taught to... they're raised, I remember from school, and you probably got this too, Andrew, because I know we grew up in the same neighborhood, actually. We were in Vancouver for a little while. School, we had drummed into our heads that we are subjects of the crown, that word subject. Whereas in America, you said, no, you're a citizen of a republic. It may not be true in practice, but at least, you know, it's a different kind of idea put in the young heads at a young age.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, go ahead.
It says right on the Canadian passport that, you know, this person is a subject of the Queen, and so there you go. It's a stated master servant relationship to the polite spin.
Well, Kevin, let me ask you guys this, because there's always been, when I first got in the radio, actually, I just had my fifth anniversary show I recorded last night. And I read an email from one of the first listeners that ever contacted the radio station. And one of the topics I was discussing that day was something called the sovereign citizen movement. Now, what is the difference between the sovereign citizen movement, the free man on the land, and all of these other associated groups that claim the birth certificate, the social security number, and all of that as a way that basically tags and numbers you as a commodity to a corporation?
Well, I just want to throw in something, Andrew, before you say comment on that, we actually, I was meeting the other day with somebody, and I won't say where it is exactly, but it's in a part of Canada, who has been targeted he's been accused of threatening a bailiff in the court simply by sending him a notice that he intended to, if he continued to harass him, he would charge him a certain amount of money. This bailiff came back and accused him of being a, quote, freeman on the land because he used the word sovereignty. Now, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the FBI have both named, quote, freeman on the land as a terrorist organization, even though it's not even an organization. It's more like an idea. But if you want to get rid of somebody, and now in Canada or in the U.S., you just label them freeman on the land, because the word sovereign is considered you know, a terrorist terminology, even though it's continually used by the founding fathers of America. So, you know, go figure.
Well, what they're obviously saying is the rule of law is dead. I would say the thing that's common between all these individuals, and you're right, there's no organized movement that I'm aware of. It's what happens to an individual when you start to dig in and understand the level of tyranny under which everyone exists. And so it's really just a response trying to say, look, you know, you can create all these rules and regulations to keep us in our place, but the fact is we're born free and we're meant to live free, and anybody who tries to take that away is committing a crime. I think it's quite straightforward.
Well, that's how this country was formed in the beginning, and a lot of people, they look at these ideas of being independent and sovereign and standing up against a corrupt, tyrannical system as being some act of treason, which in and of itself it is to a certain extent, because the Founding Fathers, when they created this nation, it was an act of treason going against and declaring independence from the crown. And we are essentially having to do that again from the same tyrannical system that has essentially taken the country back over, occupied it through these offshore corporate international banking cartels and houses, which is one of the main causes for the American Revolution to begin with.
Right, and we had a perfect example of that when, a.k.a. Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio's visit to America, in which he's just arguing the whole kind of corporatist Agenda 2030, you know, position right down the hilt. But
right.
It's almost like we're in a struggle here now between the corporatist system that's being imposed on the whole planet and really just kind of men and women covenanting among each other to form this kind of sovereign community themselves. It's almost like there's those two polarities going on, and we have to choose which one we're going to follow.
Well, that's right. What we're being told is that we're all too stupid to manage our own affairs and that we need a scientific and a bureaucratic elite to tell us what to do, how to live. Ultimately, you follow Agenda 21 and the new Agenda 2030, they make it pretty clear that the idea of private and personal property and transportation and all of that's to go away. But it's all couched in feel-good terms, like we want to end poverty, we want to end hunger. Well, who doesn't? But then again, you look at the people bringing this to us and you look at their track record and realize, wait a minute, these are the same people that, you know, created poverty in the midst of abundance. Why on earth would we trust them? You know?
Well, exactly.
Honestly, you know, and the idea that the science can save us and create a technocratic utopia, well, I hope it's absurd to everyone right on the face of it. That's ridiculous.
Andrew, I want you to, if you don't mind, recapping for, because it's been a number of months since you've been on, for new listeners, just kind of in a nutshell, your experience with Canada Revenue and what you did, just, you know, in kind of a short Coles Note version.
Right. And just to start with, you know, to be clear, one of the things that those of us who take this perspective were branded as being irresponsible and lawless, and it's not true. What I'm saying instead is that we have to be self-accountable, self-responsible, self-governing, that we're not children, we're men and women. And the only people who really want to be governed are those who are still childish, the people who still need somebody to tell them what to do. So that being said, when I found out the level of the atrocities committed by the Corporation of Canada, from the genocide of Native people to the extremely violent attack on Libya in 2011, which was led and coordinated by Canada through NATO. What I did was I looked at international law, in particular the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, which Canada is a signatory, and it makes it quite clear that it's illegal under Article 25 for an individual, as they say, a person, to support a criminal regime. Well, now that we have the evidence that Canada is such a criminal regime, we don't need to review that evidence. I feel that each of us has a moral obligation to take correct action, and that means withdrawing support and consent. So consent meaning no, don't do this in my name, right? Back to the Pope and his opening disclaimer. And the second thing is to withdraw support. So what I had said, I wrote a notice, had it notarized by the local notary in town, and sent it off to the Minister of Revenue, and I made a conditional offer of acceptance. I offered to settle any lawful obligation that I had with the corporation as long as I had the minister's personal assurance that Canada would not use any funds remitted to commit more crime, or if they did commit the crime, that he would accept the liability. not me, meaning he would pay the fine, he would do the jail time, because it can be proven that I know what Canada has done in part, okay? Because I've done radio shows, I've done websites. It can be proven that I'm not ignorant of the facts, and that's an important point. So I took what I believe to be correct action. The minister wrote back a four-page letter beginning saying, we don't understand what you said, which is crazy that the Minister of the Crown can't understand grade 10 English, but there you go. And then we were harassed, my wife and I, for a period of about 3 years after that by visiting pairs of CRA agents, probably contractors. And the interesting thing is they always sent new people, because whenever they came, I did my best to sit down with them, show them what was going on, educate them a little bit about the atrocities, explain how if I were to write them a check, I would be violating international law, asking them if they were counseling me to crime by suggesting that I do that. And invariably, after an hour or two, they would come around to see, yep, they would say something, yep, we believe that you're sincere in your beliefs. They would see that I was actually, you know, I wasn't doing this for my own benefit. In fact, I have to tell you, it's cost me a lot more than if I just played along with the system, right? You know, the way I look at it, if we sincerely want to stop the atrocities, then we have to take correct action. But what the whole thing proved to me is that the rule of law is dead. It didn't matter, you know, what was put in writing. They refused to even recognize what was done legally and lawfully. By always sending new people, they were showing me that essentially, you know, whenever people went back, they'd say, well, we're not going to get anything out of Andrew, so they send off two more to try. And eventually, they gave up trying, or they ran out of people, I don't know.
This was not, you wouldn't pay taxes to the Canadian government because of the genocide in the past against natives and also what was going on in Libya and everything overseas. What did they end up doing eventually? Did they seize anything?
They seized bank accounts, any property they could get their hands on. You know, they took it all. So, you know, again, you know, they were claiming that the Tax Act is superior to international law.
Right. Any thoughts, Ryan?
my initial thoughts is just to kind of go general and break the paradigm is that most people, I think, feel as if, you know, we've made these massive strides in the past couple of decades, the past couple of centuries, and that men and women in a lot of different countries, not just the U.S., but all over the world, have some sort of freedom because perceptually the walls of that prison system, the walls of serfdom and having to bow down to a king, a queen, an emperor have been expanded so far that you can't actually see them. Nowadays, when you have an idea of democracy, have an idea of freedom, all that idea really is just an idea. It's an image that's presented to the people to prevent them from rebelling. And when you do something like you did, Andrew, when you stand up against that taxing system, which here in the U.S., the 16th Amendment for a collection of basically a corporate gains tax is actually illegal. It was never officially ratified completely by all of the states. And when people stand up against that, you see the full force of the corporation come back at you. Nothing has really changed in the past couple thousand years from this image of serfdom and having to bow down to these tyrannical bloodline families. The only thing that has been altered is our perception of being a slave to now being, or at least thinking that we're free, and that prevents people from rebelling against the system, I think. That's my initial thought.
Right.
Yeah, well, I fully agree. Yep.
I want to also relate this when we're talking about kind of the thousands of years old. It's very interesting that when Bergoglio was in New York at the UN, and he made that statement, I'm speaking only in my own name. He's flaunting the fact that he's not really the Pope, and we know that for a fact, that Pope Benedict never really stepped down. He just went into the background a little bit to avoid arrest and all this. And they brought in a paid actor, a Jesuit, who that's their job. They've been disseminating for 4.5 centuries. And he's not actually the Bishop of Rome. And so he can go around, fly around the world and make all these statements that really don't have any bearing. You know, another clue about that is when he said he gave priests the right to absolve women if they have abortions. I mean, there's no way that any bishop of Rome under the control of the Cardinal of College of Cardinals would be allowed to make such a statement, but you can if you're an actor and just operating. So people are being fooled in a massive way, and yet they look at it, and people said, you know, there was Bergoglio fever all over America, and sure, it's bought and paid for and everything, but there's this weird kind of need to be a serf. And I want to talk about that in the second half. What is it in people where they need these father figures who are open criminals, being proven to be criminals, and yet they're adulated, even by non-Catholics, even by atheists, for God's sake. You know, they love this guy. And so what is it that causes people to do that? I want us to kind of reflect on that. Any thoughts in the last 5 minutes before the break about any of that?
I have one thought on what you just said about a Bergoglio, though, and I heard him say that he comes in his own name. But I also was thinking that, you know, priests, we call them father. Now, Kevin, I know you were a priest. Isn't this kind of like an inversion of the origins and the truth that's involved? I say truth very loosely. That's involved within Christianity, Catholicism, that nobody should be called the father except God, and yet we call priests our father. It's part of that father figure mentality, kind of that image of what wanted to talk about.
I was never a Catholic priest. I was a Protestant clergyman, but so, perish the thought. You know, the ancestors would turn over the grave if they heard that, Ron. But anyway, no, I think it's Matthew 23:9 or something where it says, call no one on earth Father because you have one Father in heaven. I mean, time and again, the Vatican just completely blow away everything that Jesus ever said. And I think we don't need to prove that. It's been shown over and over. But that whole mentality, and I wanted to get Andrew's thoughts about this too, of there having to be a worldly father figure, he's really a replacement. And that's, in fact, what the word vicar of Christ means. Vicarious under the law, unless I'm wrong, means to substitute for or replace. A vicar of Christ means we've replaced Christ with this papal father figure. And that's, in fact, what Papa means, papal father, right? Go ahead, Andrew.
The only thing I can think, and maybe this sounds harsh to people, is that there is such insecurity in most people that they need that reassurance from the father figure, and they're willing to overlook and call mistakes. Any level of wrongdoing, it just doesn't seem to matter. Oh, it's okay. It's in the past. Forgive it. You know, we need a leader. We need somebody to have vision and carry us through and tell us how to do it and what to do, even though the guy has absolutely no track record of running anything at all.
No.
You know, why would you trust this guy to run the lives of 6 billion people when, as far as we know, he couldn't even run a deli?
Well, you know, it's interesting because you don't have to have been actually abused individually to be traumatized. All you have to do is live in a collective situation of abuse to take on a lot of those attributes. And that's kind of the big problem here. You know, it's, we can understand when people are individually, you know, violated at a young age, why they tend to not be able to lift their hand or thought against authority. But the point is, even people who haven't been go along with that in the herd mentality. And, you know, we'll talk about more of that in the second half. I wanted to just take a break now. It's near the bottom of the hour, and we're going to be entertained once again by our friend George Carlin. Take it away, George. We're back, and we were talking about why is it that people need father figures. Ryan and Andrew, welcome back. Any thoughts?
Andrew, do you have anything to say something?
Well, again, back to that insecurity, it seems to me that, again, most people, for whatever reasons, are motivated by fear, as opposed to the opposite when working from love. You know, I hear a lot of reasons, but I think, as we've discussed before, Kevin, that people have been conditioned and dumbed down to the point where once we move into something that is new or threatening to people, that they literally shut down. So they go into personal fear, and then that's it. People in fear, as we know, are easily herded and manipulated. And also, as we know, people in love, you know, they're their own masters.
This also starts from a very young age, too, because in the standard schooling system that's run by most of the states, teach kids, and just in general, parents teach your kids the same thing, whether it's science or history or math. You always give kids this polar dichotomy of what is or what is not possible. So in terms of, I don't know, science, if you tell these kids in a classroom where they're going to learn that, you know, science is only viable up to a certain point, and then we can't understand these other things. We're not going to be able to build this other technology. It just doesn't exist. It can't exist. I mean, for an example, if you look at the U.S. Patent Office, they will not allow anybody to even submit a patent, not even a submission, for any type of perpetual motion device, because in their minds and the scientific community, that cannot exist. So that is a way to put a bar on that type of technological advancement, even though behind the scenes, this type of technology actually exists. And it's a way to basically prevent the proles, if you will, to prevent the serfs from being able to understand that much more is possible than what's been presented to them. So they rely on the people that have given them this prison system that tells them, no, that's not possible, only this is possible. So you work only towards that end. And this is the same thing that we are taught in every single form of education from the time we are young. And it's basically preparation for a life of servitude is the way that I see it. I mean, and that's just in general across the globe. We seem to have this mindset because everything else outside of what seems so simple and easy, it just takes so much more time. It's much more difficult to take responsibility for ourselves. We'd rather just rely on the instant gratification, the technology, and just let everybody else handle it for us. And we just delegate our authority elsewhere, and we give up our independence.
Well, you know, I've had an example of that recently, too. People have been asking, like, what happened at all these protests that were scheduled, you know, when so-called Pope was in America. The reality is they didn't happen. I mean, a few individuals showed up, but there was no organized response at all. And the only thing that made the news was the canonization of this missionary, Junipero Serra, the California missionary who was responsible for the enslavement and murder of thousands of Indians, who Jorge Bergoglio loves. He said, we admire the man's zeal. And he canonized the guy. Well, there was a mild little protest, and in various editorial columns, people, including on CNN, they described how there had been some opposition to this canonization, but that's the only thing that made the news, and basically none of the groups that said they were going to come on protest the Pope did. So I think I tie into that whole thing. Go ahead.
I want to interject something here. I believe I sent this to you. 4 days after the canonization, some of the statues of Junipero Serra were actually vandalized. Right. And most of the news outlets that reported on this, including the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, ABC News, they claim that the vandalization of the statues of Junipero Serra was actually a hate crime to take this statue down. It was a hate crime, I guess, against the church and a hate crime against these missionaries, even though this is the man who came to this country before it was a country, who just came to this land and basically committed mass genocide and slaughtered the natives on the west coast of the United States. But the destruction of his statue is a hate crime.
Right. You can destroy human beings. That's not hate, but...
and it also shows that thinking that somehow hatred is a problem, but don't we all hate a murderer? If somebody who takes a life for no other good reason than to advance their own cause, isn't that somebody worthy and deserving of hatred?
Well, yeah.
I don't know.
And the question, too, you know, like I always, one of my failings is I always assume people are further along than they actually are. And, you know, we've talked a lot, taking it back to Kannada for a minute. There, you know, there was a lot of talk of people, you know, wanting to form common law courts, for example, or local people's assemblies mm-hmm. where they can begin to create an alternative to the so-called Dominion of Canada. But people won't go beyond talk. And this is what we're finding on the various groups I've been working with. And there was a lot of people who did respond initially to the Republic, you know, back in January. But it never went further than discussion because people would always end up saying the same thing. Well, aren't I going to get in trouble if we do this? You know, what if the police come and arrest us for doing this common law court? They can't move past that fear.
Yeah. I think that's just a natural reaction. Go ahead, Andrew.
Well, it's as if we weren't in mortal danger anyway. I mean, to me, the rational balance is if I don't do something, then I and my family and descendants will be even worse off. We're in the situation we are because our ancestors either didn't know or couldn't take correct action, and this cycle will continue unless we stop it. Now, there's always been a few of us through the generations that have tried to point it out, but as you say, most people, and what I would go further to say in this landmass known as Canada, so many people, the vast majority, are so invested in having it and keeping it the way it is that to admit that there's something that needs fundamental change, they'd have to admit their own culpability, and people simply can't go there. They can't. All they can say is, "What's it got to do with me? That happened before I got here."
And bingo.
Somehow living off the avails of stolen property is not a crime. It is a crime.
Right. The avails of genocide. Well, you know, our friend Katie Stokwa often describes her experience, and she's one of the indefatigable ones. She's out there still in front of churches, handing out stuff. She personally went around on the East Coast to a whole number of churches. And was just out there by herself handing out flyers about the genocide, the residential school mass murder. And the way she describes it is that people uniformly going into these churches were more upset at what she was doing than the fact of what their church had done to these innocent children. And they were saying, like, how dare you spread these things about our church that's going to upset the children, or that kind of mentality, right? So what is there, are people really that dissociated that they can't make a connection between putting money in a collection plate to help cover up these crimes and ongoing crimes? I mean, these aren't things in the past.
I suggested to my mother-in-law up in Royston on Vancouver Island, I'll name the location and the church where she goes because we were talking about you a few years ago, and I suggested she approach her reverend and suggest that you come and speak to the church. And so she did, not knowing much about you. How funny. And the reverend said, "Oh, that Kevin Annett, he's a troublemaker." And all I could ask was, "Oh, yeah? For whom?"
Troublemaker. Oh. I love it. As if you see in Canada.
You're a troublemaker, Kevin.
It's the C word, we call it in Canada, the controversy. It's like an obscene word. I guess they don't read their Bible. I guess they don't read what Jesus did, you know, if they're worried about troublemakers.
Well, of course, you know, they've got this, you know, I mean, the vision that most people have of Jesus has got to be in stark contrast to the guy that existed, assuming he did, of course. But, yeah, wasn't he a bit of a troublemaker when he was tossing the moneylenders out of the temple? I mean, you know, that was surely an act of violence.
I think that was part of the reason they changed the image of Jesus, where the last time I was in a church, I actually went to a service with a friend of mine. They had these images of Jesus on the wall, supposedly Jesus. He had long blonde hair, blue eyes, pale white skin. They made him out to look like some new age savior to mankind from some cult or something. And I'm thinking, I mean, do people really look at that and think that's definitely what Jesus looked like? And then, and if you suggest to them that maybe his skin was darker, all of a sudden that's somehow racist, it's anti-religion, it's sacrilegious. I mean, just the absolute ignorance of history and the unwillingness for people to admit that there's something a little bit off there. And it's what you said, Andrew. People are afraid to identify with these issues, because by identifying with these issues, they've now found an issue with themselves, and people are so insecure, and it's been beaten into them since the time they've been a child. They don't want to have to admit to having to take responsibility for something. They'd rather just coalesce with the crimes and go along with it and not worry about it. It's one of those things, just like Bill Hicks said, go back to bed, America. Your government's in control. People just don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, well, it's funny. The one of those times we occupied the big Catholic cathedral in Vancouver, one of the priests, of course, they were very upset with what we did. These wild Indians daring to go into their mass, right, and talking about murder, children. And one of the priests had me in an arm lock. It's quite funny. When we were standing up at the front, it was holding the banner about all the children needing a proper burial. And this priest had his arm in mine, and was trying to twist me to get me out the door. And he said, "We've asked you to leave." And I said, "Well, we've asked you to tell us where you buried all these children." He got really angry. I thought he was going to hit me. And then I couldn't resist. You know, I'm just like a little trickster or something. But I said to him, "You know, there's a lot more evidence we have that children were murdered by a church than you have that Jesus ever existed. Can you point to concrete evidence that the man actually existed?" Well, we have concrete documents and eyewitnesses. And that just blew him away. He didn't know how to respond. So at that point, he turned around and walked out. And, you know, I mean, it's when you confront people with the contradictions, you have those moments where things open up, but then, you know, people are looking around for some kind of leader to lead them into the promised land, and that doesn't happen, right?
Yeah, I think we also have to realize that, I mean, just in general society, guys, that there are leaders and there are followers, and that there's a lot more followers than there are leaders. So those of us who are leaders like us, we have to stand up and take the lead. And hopefully people, if we show them those facts, we bring them that reason, that logic, that rationale, then they'll follow in that right direction.
Well, that's certainly true. We have to work with the people for whom there is a possibility. And, you know, as an example of someone for whom there's no possibility, that priest you dealt with, it wouldn't matter what you said or did, I'm quite sure. I can't think of any possible way to get them to nudge or budge at all. So,
well,
yeah,
I got a funny story about that priest, too. His name is Glenn Dion. He's still the chief priest at Holy Rosary Catholic Church in downtown Vancouver. And it's the week after we did the occupation, the stuff was all over the news about it. And it, like I said, it directly led to the government getting up the next, about 3 weeks later in Parliament and talking about the missing children. So it directly helped lead to that. But because of all the publicity we're getting, I got approached by a guy who used to be the cook at Holy Rosary Cathedral. And he had been trying to sue this Glenn Dion because this man had been taking money regularly out of the collection plate. He says Glenn Dion has probably stolen over $10,000 out of the one collection plate in the last few months. And he said he went to the police. They wouldn't do anything. The lawyers wouldn't do anything. This guy's got protection, just like the mob, right? So when he was turning all red and flustered, it's because he knew of his own guilt, and he didn't want this shit coming out in case maybe he got fingered, right? That's in microcosm what they're all about. They all know they're guilty. They're all interconnected network of thieves and murderers. And they're, you know, they all have to cover each other or they'll be in hot water.
Well, we know from the documents that came out of the court case on the East Coast there a couple of years ago that something like one in three of the priests, some 300-odd priests out of the 1,000 in the diocese, were known to be sex offenders. And so that was known, you know, they tried to, you know, the prosecutor tried to tie it back to Rome but was unsuccessful. Managed to get one of the cardinals in jail for a short spell, at least.
Oh, Philadelphia, yeah. William Lynn,
Yeah, in Philadelphia, exactly. And so, again, you know, that's an astonishing number that a third of the priests were sex offenders. It means the other two-thirds had to know. There's no way you could have so many without the entire establishment knowing, without Rome knowing. It just defies belief. If people
say they not only know, Andrew, but of course, to remind new listeners, it's the policy. They've got to silence children who are harmed. They've got to protect the perpetrator or they'll be excommunicated, and the police are not to be told. It says that in Crimen Solicitanus. So when
That's
William
true.
Lynn goes to jail for 6 months, he's taking the rap for the fact that from the Pope on down, they're all supposed to protect child rapists. Now, how a criminal body like that is allowed to operate, somebody explain to me.
I think that's another main reason why they chose at least a guy, obviously he's a Jesuit, Jorge Bergoglio, But the image that they've tried to brand him with from day one, where they've got a picture of him in the New York Times paying his own hotel bill, and they act like he's some great reformer, they bring him about just like they brought Obama about, as this person who's supposed to appeal to this mass guilt in the general population, as a person who's going to reform all the ills of the church. And they do that because as people begin to wake up in America, we think that we've made progress. So, yes, let's just elect a black man as president. People in the whole world, not just Catholics, Christians, or anybody of a religious affiliation, atheists alike, as you said before, Kevin, they look at this guy and they say, well, we know there's problems in the church. Whether you're an atheist or a Catholic, you do know this. So this guy, he's standing up. He wants to make a difference. He's saying we have a zero tolerance policy. Then he turns around and basically orders people to cover these situations up. And people don't see that. They only see what's on the surface. They see what their father's telling them, and their father wouldn't lie to them, would he?
Well, zero tolerance policy is that's a very important – that term, zero tolerance policy, lawyer's term, it actually – think about it for a minute. What does tolerance mean? It's just an attitude. So you can say, yeah, I personally have a zero tolerance policy, but in practice we're still going to protect the child rapists. It may be a policy, but who the hell enforces the policy? I mean, I got fired from the United Church because I stood on their policy that native land was not to be sold off to private white corporations. I just quoted the policy, but I got fired because, in fact, you know, Weyerhaeuser and McMillan Bordell were profiting off land, stolen native land on Vancouver Island, thanks to the United Church of Canada. So we have a policy, but then there's the practice, right? And the practice is, as Bergoglio himself said to the Italian bishops, you are not to tell the police when children are raped. That happened just a few months ago. And so he's saying one thing to the public, one thing to the church members, and that's what you do in a spin operation.
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Bernays would be proud, the guy who coined the term public relations. This has got to be the biggest public relations scam in, certainly recent history.
It is, and that's the point is that the Vatican, you know, I think we can, pat ourselves on the back to some degree for having helped cause this. They have had a multi-million dollar campaign to not just do a facelift on the Vatican, but to indemnify themselves permanently because of the mountain of all this evidence coming out about their criminality. And they're in deep damage control operation. In fact, this is indicative of a crisis. I think it's historically very reminiscent to what happened at the time of the Reformation. You're going to see new splits happening in the church, and you're seeing it already between the Bergoglio and the Ratzinger factions.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's very important. Good. Remember, there are essentially two popes at this point.
Right.
Now, wonder how they get along.
Well, Bergoglio doesn't go to Rome very much, and people I've spoken to in Italy, it's a standing joke that the Pope might get whacked if he goes near Vatican City, so it's quite amusing, actually.
That's happened before.
it happened in 1978 to John Paul I, yep.
So just after, 33 days in office?
33 days, a healthy man.
Yeah, then he ended up poisoned by the P2 Masonic Lodge and the Holy Alliance, which is the Jesuit-run assassination bureau, which has been around since the time of, the 1500s. But one thing I wanted to flag for people listening, on itccs.org, there's just been posted a flyer which people are going to attempt to hand out at polling stations across Canada, telling people why they should not vote. So go to the latest posting, itccs.org. It's in English and French. And please run that off and hand it out to your neighbors and go to polling stations and say, do not go in there. By voting for these people, you're handing over your sovereign authority to a criminal, Queen Elizabeth II, who abducted and disappeared 10 Aboriginal children personally in 1964, and who's responsible for the genocide in the residential schools, convicted in a court of law in Brussels, and you cannot be handing your authority over to this person via these political parties you're electing. So please read that, hand it out, and try to do some consciousness raising and detach from the system, people. Please do not pay taxes or vote. What do you think, guys? We've got about 5 minutes left.
I have a comment/question for you.
Okay, well, Andrew, say something, and then Ryan.
No, go ahead, Ryan. Yeah, go ahead. You put the question right there.
So you say don't pay taxes, don't vote. But for maybe the listeners that are just coming on to the tail end of this broadcast, if you could sum it up very quickly, why should they not be voting, like a very specific reason why, because most people, they just hear, well, don't do it because this is a criminal body that probably doesn't register with people. And also, how must they detach themselves from this system? Is it just not paying taxes? Is it just not voting? Or are there other ways as well?
We don't have time for all the details, Ryan, but in a nutshell, you know, you're voting for representatives who take an oath of allegiance to a foreign ruler, not to the people or the Constitution. That in itself, under the law, is an act of treason. You're handing over the authority of a government to a foreign power. So any voting in Canada is treasonable. It's also supporting criminality by allowing people who are already convicted of crimes to continue, you know, as a legitimate power. Andrew, any remarks, final remarks?
Yeah, and everything you said, to the best of my knowledge, is true. I would go further, for people that can't accept that, take a look at Power Corporation in Canada, the Desmarais family. You'll find that most of the recent prime ministers have worked for them. Bob Rae's brother worked for him. Maurice Strong was their president at age 35. I don't have time to go into the details, but he's the bag man for all the green NGOs in Canada, from Suzuki Foundation to WCWC to Pollution Probe. When I say bag man, he's the guy who brings the bags of money that allow these things to happen. So all four parties in Canada are essentially fronts for Power Corp, which is itself a front for the Rockefellers / Rothschild. So whomever you vote for, you're simply giving your permission to the banks, which are also part of the Crown, to run your life. And if you think that there's a difference between the four, look at who runs them.
Right. And Andrew, I would like you to come on again and talk about the whole Power Corporation thing. They're part of the big movers and shakers in Canada historically. So please come back on and we can get into that.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming
your
on,
pleasure.
Brother, and telling us your valiant attempt to take on CRA. Ryan, final remarks or announcements about your own stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, for 3 hours, as always, The Secret Teachings. You can find a link to the show at thesecretteachings.info. Tonight's program, I do have a guest, but before I get to my guest tonight, I'm going to do about an hour and a half, and I'm giving a very extensive, detailed, and factual basis / translation, quote-unquote translation, of the new 17 points to sustainable development out of the new Agenda 2030. So that'll be very vital for people if they want to understand the inner workings of what this new agenda entails.
Thanks, Ryan, and thanks, Andrew. It's great to be with you guys, as always. And for listeners, tune back here, 6 p.m. Eastern, kannadarepublic.caitccs.org. And if you want to write to us, republicofkannada@gmail.com. Until next week, stay strong, stay clear, and break from the system for your own life, for your own sake. Thanks. Bye for now.